We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Welcome to Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast.
Building things can be really hard, and entrepreneurship is often portrayed in the media as the sexy or even worse, easy career path. Through this series, we plan to pull back the curtain and tell the gritty stories of entrepreneurship. We're striving to create a relaxed environment where entrepreneurs feel free to tell their stories.
This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast.
Hi there, I'm Jeremy Scheinwald, and I'm your host of Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast. I'll talk about myself in a minute and our first guest, Andrew Yang, founder of Venture for America, in a moment as well. But for now, let me say a word about VFA. For those of you who are tuning in and are unaware of what Venture for America is all about. So Venture for America is an organization that is committed to building companies and revitalizing cities across America through entrepreneurship. And what that means is VFA takes top graduates from across the country and helps them find positions with entrepreneurial companies in cities that may not normally have the core attraction for those graduates. So we send people from top schools to cities like Detroit and San Antonio and New Orleans, cities where they need young, amazing talent, and we fill the ranks of their entrepreneurial ventures and hope that they'll flourish and hope that these people will stay and help to build new companies and to revitalize those cities by creating jobs. So that's VFA in a nutshell. Today, I am interviewing, I must admit, I'm interviewing an old friend of mine. Andrew Yang and I have been friends for quite a long time and we're business affiliates for quite a long time as well. Andrew, as I noted, is the founder and CEO of Venture for America and has worked with startups and early stage growth companies for about the last 12 years. Prior to that, I came to know him when he became CEO and president of Manhattan GMAT, a test prep company that was acquired by the Washington Post/Kaplan in 2009. He also served as the co-founder of an internet company and as an executive at a healthcare software startup. Andrew was named a champion of change by the White House for his work with VFA and one of Fast Company's 100 most creative people in business, among other awards. He's the author of Smart People Should Build Things, published by Harper Business, about the ideas behind VFA. He's appeared on CNBC, Morning Joe, Fox News. You name the media outlet, Andrew has been there. He's a graduate of Columbia Law School and Brown University, and he lives in New York City with his wife, son, and little fluffy white dog. And Andrew, I think you'll find, is a great interview. He's a colorful storyteller. I guess the easy part here, I am Jeremy Scheinwald. I am the founder of missiondrivengroup.com. You can check that out. We're a portfolio of student-related companies, which is where we jibe quite nicely with Andrew's old company, Manhattan GMAT, where we still have a partnership to this day. And I'm a committed entrepreneur. There are four companies under our brands and under our umbrella. And this is a real labor of love for me. I'm excited about this podcast because it's going to give me an opportunity to interview many other entrepreneurs and to hear the gritty stories. Today, entrepreneurship is very glamorous, and it seems like not a day goes by without hearing about another massive round of funding. And we're going to hear the stories of entrepreneurs before they get there. We're hoping to hear some stories from entrepreneurs where maybe it didn't work out. And we're hoping to hear some of, again, the gritty stories, the occasional entrepreneur who had to sleep under his desk to save a buck or meet payroll by putting it all on his or her credit card. So those are the stories that I'm excited to tell. And I hope that you'll stick with me through this journey and enjoy this pilot and tune in regularly. Thank you very much and enjoy the show.
This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast, a show about entrepreneurs and their stories. Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it. This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast.
We're here with Venture for America founder Andrew Yang. Thanks for being here, Andrew.
It's my pleasure, Jeremy.
I guess considering it's a VFA podcast, you kind of got to be here.
Yes, my appearance was inevitable.
Well, this is the pilot, and we're thrilled to have you as our first guest. We all know you as the founder of VFA and as the former CEO of Manhattan GMAT as well. But at first, you were a lawyer. What led you down that path?
You know, I graduated from Brown in 96 with an economics degree and didn't know what to do. And law school was just one of those things you did if you didn't know what to do at that time. You know, I went to law school here in New York at Columbia, and I'd say a significant proportion of the people there were sort of like me, where they just sort of had stumbled into law school. And I found law school didn't clarify a whole lot, and so I became a corporate attorney here in New York, also at a law firm, Davis Polk & Wardwell. So that law firm experience was great, in part because it made me more detail-oriented, but in part because it inoculated me against certain forms of work. I only lasted about 5 months as a corporate attorney before leaving to co-found a company. So there was not a great approach in terms of choosing law school as a path after college.
And Davis Polk, prestige firm here in New York, was there any pressure on you to stay? Family pressure? I don't know. Did you feel any loss of prestige leaving? What led you to leave, and how did others and you deal with it?
Well, it was certainly a bit of a leap in that I was getting paid moderately well as a lawyer, and I was not getting paid anything when I started a company. It was quite the opposite. I was going around asking people for money. And my parents were nervous and concerned. I told them, look, don't worry about me. I'll figure it out. I'd saved about $10,000 from my time at the firm, which I thought would last me like a certain number of months. Went through that, ended up going to credit cards, maxed out credit cards. It was, I think, about 8 or 9 months before someone actually invested in the company. I remember running to the bank after we got that first check so I could cash it before they changed their minds. So that it was certainly a big leap of faith, but I felt very confident that I'd rather be trying to build something rather than be the guy who is documenting someone else building something, which is essentially what my job was as a lawyer.
So what was that you built? What was that first venture?
It was a very dot-com 1.0 idea. It was called stargiving.com. We were a combination of something called a hunger site, which is now freerice.com, and celebrity-affiliated fundraising. So you would get Magic Johnson or Hootie and the Blowfish to donate a meet and greet with themselves to benefit a nonprofit they liked. And then if someone clicked on the button, they were shown sponsors that would donate to the nonprofit. And then one person who clicked on the button would actually meet the celebrities. So it was like a combination of click to donate and then also celebrity meet and greets to raise money for charity.
Was it before its time, or
I'm happy to say that now, approximately 15 years later, a company is doing this successfully. So, you know, there's a startup saying is that being too early is the same as being wrong. And certainly it felt very wrong when the bubble burst and the tide went out and, our little company wasn't able to survive.
So how long were you at StarGiving.com for?
It was about the better part of 2 years or so. When the company went under, I still owed $100,000 in law school debt because that hadn't magically evaporated. I was like 25, 26, just lost people another $250,000 in investment. So it was my professional low, I'm sure. I remember lying on the floor looking up being like, wow, like, you know, things don't look so good. And my parents were really concerned at this point. I have to say that period made me feel like I could go through just about anything for the next number of years afterwards, because you realize that, you know, you survive, everyone else survives, and everyone just, finds other things to do and to build.
And so then I think, so you dip back into the entrepreneurial world briefly, and then through some event promotion and the like?
Well, I went from Stargaming's failure. I mean, honestly, I needed a job. I didn't have any money. I owed, you know, I used to call my law school debt my mistress because it was like I was like sending a check to support some family someplace else. You know, I mean, it was like over $1,000 a month. I was like, wow, you know, that you could like feed some people on that. So I just needed a job. I had friends who referred me to various people, and I ended up working with a small team at a wireless software company called Crisp Wireless that then ran out of money within the first number of months I was working there. So I was like back to living on credit cards, and I saw, you know, like colleagues of mine like get evicted and like move into our office with their like, you know, sleeping bags and stuff. People like sleeping in the conference room. And this was 2002, which was a rough time economically overall. So I was pretty discouraged. I went from there to another startup that raised about $7 million and was much more stable. And I was there for 4 years. I was a healthcare software company. And while I was there, and because, you know, you and I knew each other shortly thereafter, like I started throwing parties on the side as a way to really, honestly, meet women.
I thought you were going to go with whet the entrepreneurial appetite more corporate. it was to meet women. Got it.
Well, so I was talking to friends, and they were like, hey, you know, we live in these tiny apartments. Like, how are we going to host people? It's like, well, we certainly can't host people in our apartments because, you know, we like live with roommates and we live on top of each other. So I was like, well, you know, if you threw parties at a lounge, I mean, it would be sort of like hosting something. So that was the catalyst for it. And then it ended up being a great learning experience. I also took to teaching the GMAT on the side. I was introduced to Zeek around 2002 as well, 2001 actually. And so I was doing a couple things on the side while I was working for the healthcare software company.
So tell us about your evolution at Manhattan GMAT and how you found Zeek and how your role continued to grow there.
So I met Zeek at a Starbucks. At the time, he was working alone. It was a one-person company, and I was the first curriculum developer where I wrote some problem sets for his first materials, or the company's first materials, and this was 2001. We were introduced because I went to high school with Zeek's college roommate, my friend reached out and said, hey, I really want you to meet my friend Zeek. I think that you're really good at tests.
For appropriate context here, by the way, Zeek Vanderhoek, the founder of Manhattan GMAT.
Yeah, it's funny. I guess I had a reputation for being good at tests. So they were like, hey, you know, you're really, really good at filling out bubbles. You know, you should meet with Zeek because he's helping people do well on the GMAT. So Zeek and I met in a Starbucks, and then I did some work for Zeek, and we became friends. And then Zeek would have me fill in for him when he couldn't do something. So I remember there was an info session literally at a deli downtown. And I should ask Zeek about this. I have to think like he was quote unquote unavailable just because he didn't want to do it. so like I go to this deli and I'm like talking to people about the GMAT. You know, I think we got a little bit of business out of it. So that was like 2002, 2003. I did another presentation at a bar and I swear like no one wanted to listen to the GMAT. There was like music. There were, you know, it was like a happy hour, people mingling. So I would fill in for Zeek, maybe in part because I would take difficult assignments, but Zeek saw me as someone who could add value beyond the classroom. So he and I would talk about the business sometimes. I would teach courses periodically. And so he started seeing me as someone who could potentially even evolve into the head of the business if he decided to step away.
I love the delis and bars, I think, is definitely peeling back the layers on entrepreneurship and getting to the heart of it there.
Yeah. Meanwhile, now Manhattan GMAT, as you know, is like the biggest GMAT prep company in the country.
So you started as an instructor. You started helping with problem sets. How did you continue to evolve into CEO?
Well, so Zeek and I would talk about the business. I mean, he knew that I'd co-founded a company that did not work out, but, you know, had some executive experience. And then at MMF, I was running a team, so we would talk about how each business was growing. And part of it is that we became friends, and I believe he liked and trusted me. And so when he started looking for people to serve in an executive capacity, he was looking for someone who knew the product. So that was a relatively small group of people because there weren't that many instructors. As you know, Manhattan GMAT required a 99th percentile score in the GMAT, so you're already like excluding a whole lot of the population as like potential managers. So he wanted someone who was a teacher, knew the product, but also that he knew and trusted and had a sense of their operating in a business context. So I have to admit, it was probably a relatively small group of people to choose from at that time.
So give us some context here. Tell us about the growth of Manhattan GMAT from the time that you took over, I suppose. Or maybe tell us about where it was when you took over, and then tell us where you took it.
Well, when I joined the company, it had 6 employees. It was very small. All of us were piled into this little office. And there was like one half of one floor with one classroom and then a second room that we used as a computer lab. And we were in a couple of other places, but no other offices. The whole business was really quite modest. It was like a well-regarded boutique. In terms of revenues, I mean, when I joined, it was between 2 and 3 million, and this year it'll be something like almost 10 times that. So the next number of years were really positive for the business. When I took over the business as CEO, the full-time team was maybe 10 people, and now including instructors. Not quite apples to oranges, but now the company employs over 120 people, either as instructors or team members.
And I know you and I have talked about this a lot over the years, our affinity for bootstrapping and I'm assuming the Manhattan GMAT, which became quite a juggernaut, and really became the gold standard in its niche of education, could have taken cash at a lot of points if it wanted to. Why did you guys go it alone?
Well, we were fortunate enough to be getting what I consider the best form of investment, which is just money from customers. You know, it's like it gives you a better sense as to what you're doing right and what you're not doing right. And so because we were growing and profitable, there was never that much of a need to ramp up in terms of investment capital. And that was an adjustment for me because certainly at MMF and Crisp Wireless and Stargiving, you were always courting investors. You always had this like big growth story you were selling. And I was kind of accustomed to that. It was like a venture capital mindset. And so I actually really was uncomfortable with a bootstrapping mindset for the first little while, but then I grew to love it. I still love it to this day. It's so much better to be able to focus on the business and be responsive to what your customers are enjoying or not enjoying, as opposed to telling stories to investors. Because so often you end up serving more than one master, and a business is best when you're only serving one.
And all this time, you're battling a better-funded incumbent, and this incumbent is trying so hard to take you down that they've printed bumper stickers that say "Take that, Andrew Yang." This is a fact. This is not a hyperbole or an urban myth. They actually went and printed bumper stickers. Were there moments where you were just like, "How are we gonna climb this mountain?" Or were you fearless throughout?
You know what? One benefit to Manhattan GMAT. So when I was at these other companies, I was always hustling and networking and feeling like, hey, if I could like meet someone who maybe wants to invest or can help the company in some way. When you run an educational business like Manhattan Prep, there really aren't that many people that can help you. You know what I mean? Especially if you're not looking for money. So I had my heads down just building the business, and as a result, the context I felt like would just take care of itself. Like if we just grew and did a good job and grew and just worked diligently week in and week out, then then the market would reward us and students would achieve their goals and we'd grow. So the greater landscape in terms of Kaplan, I mean, they had obviously, you know, like tens of millions more than we did. But we felt confident that the biggest variable for an individual student is just their own outcome. And for a prospective student, it's what their friends say. And, you know, Kaplan could spend money, but they couldn't control that.
What, ultimately you sold to Kaplan. And how does this, not just the decision making around that, but how do you trust a competitor to evaluate you as a firm and go through your books and your customer lists and all those things to make sure that you're the real deal.
You know, it's funny because like years and years ago, like earlier, I get an email from the general counsel of Kaplan saying, hey, you have this thing in the forum. It's like, we don't like it. And I was like, oh, yeah, sure, we'll take it down. And, you know, because it was something like, we weren't even responsible for it. So I was just like, yeah, we'll modify that for you. And
your legal
like,
education coming in handy there.
Well, it's just like we're very happy to agree with them. And it's like, hey, hopefully we'll have some more positive things to talk about in the future. And then the general counsel actually took that as like, aha, that's interesting. And so he literally took that to the CEO and was like, hey, I think the Manhattan GMAC guys are actually like kind of friendly or like reasonable or, you know, maybe even looking. So the CEO of Kaplan then calls me up and is like, hey, you want to have lunch sometime? And this is well before any kind of acquisition of the company is being contemplated. This is like maybe, you know, 2007 or something like that. And so we just have lunch and we had lunch together maybe like once every X months, like for the years before. And so when Zeke and I were contemplating, you know, strategic options, which is like the euphemism for we're doing something, I just like pinged JP, whom I'm friends with to this day, and just said, hey, like, you know, can I come in? You want to chat? And so there's a bit of a trust relationship. And that was something that, which is funny considering we were arch rivals and like beating each other's brains out in the market every day. I actually had a sense of the leadership in terms of their personalities, and that was really helpful.
I guess I had a window into this. You got a little bit restless after the sale. How long did it take for you to start thinking like, you know, I gotta start something else. I've got that itch. And also, you walked away from what I understand, you walked away from some incentives that were there if you would have stayed longer. How did you, clearly I know how you felt about that, but what was that like?
You know, I really thought I'd enjoy working for a big company more. I thought I'd just cruise and make some money and it'd be great.
So you imagine yourself staying?
Well, I imagine myself certainly more relaxed than I was. So I thought about what would become Venture for America really for years before that, because as you know, I went to law school and thought it wasn't great, and systemically, I thought law school was really actually quite poor in the sense that there were a lot of people that are emerging that, you know, were doing jobs they weren't excited about or like constrained by the debt loads, and I'd personally taught the analyst classes at McKinsey, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, Morgan Stanley, and these companies at Manhattan GMAT, and so I saw that it wasn't just a law school thing; it was like a smart people thing, or at least a highly educated people thing, because it's not the same thing as being smart, that there were all these people doing these things that represented achievement and weren't that excited about it. And so I thought, wow, wouldn't it be amazing if there was some way to channel these same people to small and growing companies that could really use their talents, and maybe these companies could be in cities that could really use a boost. I was inspired in large part by meeting a guy named Charlie Kroll in 2000, and I want to say 2007, where I was back at Brown University for like an entrepreneurship panel, and I was there in large part to sell GMAT classes because, you know, I'm nothing if not a practical guy. So I was there, and then Charlie Kroll tells the story about how he wanted to be an investment banker at Morgan Stanley, and then he didn't get the job offer, so he starts his company in Providence, and you know they flail around for a little while, but then eventually they hit their stride. And then as we're sitting there, he's like, now my company has like 90 employees, and it's doing millions in revenue, and I've got a wife and two kids, and so if you told me I'd still be in Providence a decade later, I would have said you were crazy, but now I'm like the mayor. I didn't say he was the mayor, he's a humble guy. but that was like my interpretation. So I thought to myself, my God, if we had more people trying to build business, because Providence has an unemployment rate of like 10%. It's not exactly thriving on an unemployment basis. So I thought, wow, these 100 jobs don't exist if Charlie becomes, Morgan Stanley banker and like instead he's in Providence. So I thought, wow, if we had more people doing what Charlie actually did as opposed to what Charlie thought he wanted to do when he was 22, then the economy is different, the country is different, Providence is different. And so I had this idea really from 2007, 2008 on about what would become Venture for America. But I was like CEO of a company, so you know you really don't have that much time to do something else. I'm the sort of person who can do maximum two or three things at once, and that includes like personal life. So I'm not one of these people that's like, oh, I've got like 10 companies cooking. That's not really my bag.
But how did you, you know, you've got a job as the CEO of a company, and it's paying you well, and you're happy, and you've enjoyed it. Or maybe I'm projecting a little bit. I was there, so you seemed happy. How do you make the choice to walk away? How intense was the feeling about VFA that you could walk away from something so secure and fulfilling?
I mean, I did have a really excellent job. I love the people at Manhattan. You know, it's still like, you know, something I look back on very fondly and proudly. I owe Zeke a lot. I owe everyone who worked at Manhattan GMAT a lot. I owe you a lot. I mean, I owe a lot of people a lot of things. In terms of the fire to leave, I just became possessed of this idea that we have tons of smart, ambitious young people that were heading towards these routes that weren't going to lead them where they wanted to go, and it wasn't going to lead our country or economy where we all want to go. And so I thought that if I dedicated years of my life, I'd have a chance to maybe have a positive impact. And I also felt like I owed it to somebody because, I started a company, didn't work out. I worked with these entrepreneurs, and then, you know, eventually, like, you know, had a pretty positive outcome. I just felt like very grateful, and I felt like I needed to do something to repay it in a little bit or a lot. I mean, to the extent that I could, it just seemed like to not try to build Venture for America would have been shirking. I don't know how else to put it. Sometimes you get possessed of an idea and you just think like, okay, I'm going to do everything I can to build it. And that's the only way I know how to operate really is to commit fully to something. Like I can't cruise around in a job. Not to say, I mean, you know, being the head of a company obviously is not like a cruising job anyway, but the founding of Venture for America was something that I remember. There's one day I just looked up and was like, okay, I'm going to do this thing. And then as soon as I decide, okay, I'm going to do it, then, you know, you're all in to have any chance at success.
Absolutely. So the was there a lag? I mean, did you take any time off at all? I don't recall you taking time off.
No, I had a plan to take time off, and then the calendar didn't cooperate, and I ended up taking, I think, like 5 days off or something like that.
So 5 days after you wrap up a Manhattan GMAT, you open the doors at Venture for America. I was on the founder, that was one of the inaugural board, so I have a recollection of it, but what was it day one? I mean, who was there? And you're operating from some borrowed office space, yes. If I recall. Give us a picture of VFA, you know, day one through I don't know, a couple months in.
Sure. So my last day at work at Manhattan Prep was May 11th, 2011. So I remember that date. And I took about 5 days off. and then we had borrowed office space at Manhattan Prep. And I'd hired Eileen Lee, who's a COO. And then we had one person, Brielle Baudet, who's working in recruitment. And then the plan was to recruit the first class, which would require a lot of work on the ground. And so really for the first number of months, really the rest of 2011, Venture for America was borrowed office space, a PowerPoint deck, me and two people, and some press, because we got some press on the way out. And happily, there were people like you and other people that bought in early on as board members. So that, you know, that I don't want to diminish like what we had in terms of assets. Monetarily, I'd put in $120,000 of my own to seed the organization. It was going out without salary, and our expenses were quite low at that time because we weren't paying rent, and there were only three of us, and I wasn't getting paid. So, you know, we could stretch out the $200,000 or so we had pretty far.
This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast, a show about entrepreneurs and their stories. Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it. This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast.
You know, things start to take off. I mean, you alluded to already. You got some positive press, but what were the first big big bangs where you're like, wow, this thing's it's grabbing people's attention. It's going to happen. How did you know that it was going to make it out of those early days of self funding? Which I'm supposed to be the interviewer here, but I'm going to really tip my hat in terms of bootstrapping a charitable organization. That's pretty impressive. but back to the question itself. I mean, when were you out of the most vulnerable period?
Well, you know, that first year and a half was just scrapping the whole time. And I'd say, you know, it was probably about 2 years before it started feeling a little more stable. And even to this day, like, there are times when it still feels like we just have so much in front of us, so much to do. But I remember a couple of things. I remember in November 2012, we actually owed Brown University $50,000 and had like $25,000 in the bank, and then we got the bill. And I said to Eileen, I was like, hey, what do we do with this bill? I was like, don't pay it, don't worry about it, it'll be fine. and then happily, I got a call from one of our major partners. It would become one of our major partners, but it wasn't the case at the time, that UBS, the head of community affairs, calls me and is like, hey, you know, we'd love to work with you. You know, we're going to be contributing $200,000 to the effort, and then so we could pay the bill. But this is November 2012. And so, you know, from May 2011 to November 2012, it was hand to mouth the whole time. We really were very gritty during that time.
And how long was it between opening the doors and arriving at the White House? And why don't you tell our listeners about that?
Well, so I got an email in spring of 2012 saying invitation to meet the president. And you get that email and you're like, what the heck? Like, president of what? that's really the question I had. And then you look at it and you're like, you know what? I think they mean the president of the United States. And then you also think, wow, like, I think it's real. Like, it seems to, like, has a White House logo on it and it looks like a genuine thing. So I went to the White House and met with President Obama, talked to him about Venture for America. And, you know, this was very early on. This was honestly, in my opinion, before we'd done enough to merit it. But it certainly helped put a wind at our backs in terms of people believing that we were onto something big.
And then it just kind of exploded. I mean, we've had a couple summer celebrations. We've had, Bloomberg in, Arianna Huffington, and you got to fill in the gaps between those two phases. Or are there? I mean, it's been a pretty bit of a juggernaut, at least in terms of its public profile.
Well, the universe has been very pro-venture for America from the beginning. And I think it's because we're addressing something that everyone wants us to fix. So it helps young people and talented aspiring entrepreneurs, because from experience, how do you get better as an entrepreneur? And that's really one of the reasons why I'm very glad to share, you know, my early pitfalls and struggles, because being an entrepreneur is super difficult, and most people are going to fail the first time out. If they're lucky, they're starting very young, and then they can fail when they're like in high school, and then by the time they come out, they're like already veterans. But how you get better as an entrepreneur is really a fundamental issue. And so what we're saying is the way you get better as an entrepreneur is by working with a more experienced entrepreneur for a couple of years. And that's certainly how I developed, by working with Manu and Zeke and other people over the years. So we're helping on the talent side. On the company side, and you know this as the head of a small growth company, it's really hard to find the right people. It's very hard to recruit. It's super resource intensive. The recruitment pipelines that major firms build up cost millions or tens of millions a year. And so if you're a small firm trying to compete for talent at the college level, it's such an uphill battle that it'd be futile for most companies. So the small and growing companies that are going to really serve as the engines of job growth in America aren't getting the talent that they need. I mean, consistently, the very large firms in certain regions are going to be able to enlist the best and brightest each year. So we're helping these small growth companies. We're helping communities around the country that aren't getting access to the talent natively. really, Venture for America, I talk all the time about how it's enlightened self-interest. And I think that's one reason why we've been able to grow as fast as we have.
Give us a window into the fellow experience. What does a fellow get out of Venture for America?
Well, you know, we tried to imagine what would we want if we were graduating from college today. We were aspiring entrepreneurs. So if you get in, and it's very selective, this year we had 1,600 applications for about 140 spots. So, you know, you can get a sense of what the acceptance rate is. You come to Brown University, my alma mater, and spend 5 weeks there living and working. We bring in McKinsey and IDEO and the Flatiron School and other top firms to help give you a sense as to how to utilize design thinking or process engineering or some coding. And we have you work in teams. You make fast friends with each other. You bond socially. And then you go to different cities around the country and you work for an early stage growth company with a more experienced entrepreneur. You live often with other fellows or around other fellows. And you operate for a couple of years. We have programs for you throughout, including full-time programming staff to help try and develop you professionally. And at the end of 2 years, you're either a manager and leader at this company, which is obviously a huge win for everyone, or you potentially even start your own company. And we have an accelerator and seed fund to support that. To date, we have a couple dozen of our fellows have started 10 companies that are operating around the country, the biggest of which has raised about $500,000 and has already created about 17 manufacturing jobs in Michigan. So, and this is something, a company that was started by a 24-year-old. So it just goes to show that if you actually put support in place, you can drive very talented young people to build businesses that can help create jobs around the country.
So if you can elaborate on that particular success and maybe also highlight a few other successes, whether it's an individual who's growing their own company or just really contributing at a high level to an organization they might not have otherwise, very likely otherwise, almost impossible to have otherwise found that organization.
Well, the company I was referring to started by a guy named Brian Rudolph. He grew up in suburb of New York City, went to Emory, turned down a consulting offer to join Venture for America, went to work at an e-commerce company in Detroit, which he had never been to. So I think you're right. The odds of that happening without us would be quite low. So when he was in Detroit, now he's a bit of a health nut, and he's gluten-free. So he was working on alternative pasta recipes to keep himself fit and healthy. And he started making this chickpea pasta in his kitchen in Detroit. And then he went through a bunch of iterations, and then he hit on something that he thought people would really like. And fast forward now, it's a chickpea pasta company called Bonza that he's co-founded. It's raised, again, about $500,000, including $75K from Joe Bastianich. It's being distributed in ShopRite, Sprout, Meijer, Eataly, and other stores around the country. And it's really good. I mean, my kid likes it. You know, I mean, anyone who's listening to this, if you want some
free publicity here for
Bonza. For Bonza, I mean, yeah. It's a Bonza pasta. It's high protein, gluten-free chickpea pasta, and it's really fortifying. That company's created, again, 17 manufacturing jobs in Michigan because someone has to make the pasta. And it turns out that it's really hard to make pasta out of chickpeas. They went around the country trying to figure out where to do it, and it turns out, like, right there in Michigan was the best place for it. So that's one success story. But we don't think that everyone needs to become the founder of a company to be a success. If anything, we think the founder role has been overblown. And certainly I'd speak to that. I mean, I get way too much credit for Venture for America. I mean, there have been so many amazing people that have done incredible work making it happen. So another fellow, 2012, graduated from Boston College named Sean Lane, who then worked for a company in Providence called Swipely, which was, at that time, it was, I want to say it was like a couple dozen people. And since then, Sean's grown to become one of the key guys there, and it's like managing a whole team of, you know, I think over a dozen people. And again, this is like a 24-year-old who's really helped drive the growth of the company. They've raised, I think it was $12 million from first round capital and off to the races, and Sean's now a key figure there. So we think that every growth company needs a whole nucleus of talented team members early on. And if our fellows become part of that nucleus, and that's the goal. That's a huge win. It's not that everyone needs to start a company, because again, being a founder is just one thing, and every company needs dozens of very strong people to thrive.
So give us the VFA then and now. In year one, how many cities, how many fellows, how many applicants? And today, how many cities, how many fellows, how many applicants?
Well, in that first season, and I remember this vividly, because the way we got that first several hundred applicants was just me going to college campuses. Like, I visited 30 college campuses. I've been all around the country. And I'd go and I'd show up someplace, and sometimes there'd be literally two people there. I would have been there, and then I'd just get excited for those two people and like hope that one of them was into it, or they'd tell a friend. So that first year was like, it's like, hey, who wants to be an entrepreneur? Like, and then they raise their hand and then say, how many of you are going to go to an investment bank or management consulting firm or even law school to, quote unquote, learn about business before you try and do something? And they all raise their hand. Say, how many of you would actually prefer to go work at a startup if we could provide some of the same training and network and support that you get at these big firms? So that first year, we had about 300 applicants for 40 spots. We were in five cities, Detroit, New Orleans, Providence, Cincinnati, and Las Vegas. This year, again, we had 1,600 applications for about 140 spots, and we're in 15 cities. So we've grown a lot. Our budget, which I think of because that's what happens if you're the CEO of an organization, you start thinking about the budget. So our budget that first year was about $200,000, the majority of which was mine. And then this year, our budget will be about $5 million. So we've grown a lot in the last 4 years. And again, that there were a lot of people that made that happen.
Is it even possible to max out on cities and locations? I mean, doesn't everyone need entrepreneurship?
Yeah, really. I mean, entrepreneurship is just value add. It's like, it's a pure good. I think about the conceptual limits of what we do, and I certainly think on the talent side, we're just scratching the surface. Because how many young people want to learn how to build a business? Even our 1,600 applications this year, I think that could easily be 16,000 or 60,000. And where we're not investing heavy-duty resources into goosing our numbers, honestly. We're not trying to just, drive up, applicant levels. We're just looking for the right people. And then to your point, how many early-stage growth companies are there in our current 15 cities, plus Omaha, plus Boise, plus any number of the other cities that are calling us? Honestly, they're literally calling us saying please come to our region. So the sky's the limit in terms of the potential impact, and it's exciting to try and build a bridge to connect the talent to the need.
And I mean, there are cities who are calling you, and there are cities who are rolling out the welcome mat. I think, I believe Cincinnati was one of them that just demanded that VFA show up in town. Why don't you tell us about that experience, or the experience of transitioning from selling to being wooed?
Well, Cincinnati, I do remember this. Like, we get a call from Eric Avner, who's the senior executive at the Hale Foundation, U.S. Bank Foundation there. And he said, hey, come to Cincinnati. And we're like, we don't want to bite off too much just now, just this year. And he said, well, will you have a conference call? And I was like, sure, I'll do a conference call. I mean, it'd be kind of rude to say no to that. And so then the morning of the conference call, I asked, who's going to be on this call? And they send over a list, and it's literally 20 business leaders, community leaders, heads of foundations, entrepreneurs. And then at that point, I was like, oh, my gosh, this is actually a lot of the people that we'd want to know in this region. And then after that call, they invited us out there and drove us around and just had us meet with the various companies and leaders. And so at that point, it seemed like a no-brainer to expand to Cincinnati. And they were early in terms of figuring out what we could do. And so we do get calls. I got a call from the mayor of Boise. I mean, that's why it was top of mind. We said that he found out about us from the mayor of another city. And so there are now incoming requests, which certainly was not always the case.
So we have cities beating down your door. We have more applicants than we need. What are the not to be flippant? I mean, obviously, we cherish every applicant. but what are some of the challenges for VFA going forward?
You know, a lot of it really is about trying to meet the need on both sides, because right now we've just kept up with demand. But there's a documentary being filmed on Venture for America right now. It's going to come out next year. And I have a feeling that that's going to end up driving awareness. You know, what I never want to do is I never want to turn down someone because we just don't have the capacity. Like, it's always been driven by how many people we think have the right qualities to potentially contribute to the growth of a company or start their own someday. And that's what I want to do. I just want to keep up with that, which is going to mean significant resources. Right now, we're spending about $30,000 per fellow on recruitment, selection, training, placement, programming, support, and investment, which is actually lower than the analogous rate for organizations like ours that invest in fellowship programs. And so it's going to be, to me, the challenge of the organization to figure out just how big we can get, because, like you said, there's no limit to the amount of good we can do. I mean, it's not like you've ever found a place and said, hey, you know what, this place doesn't need more entrepreneurs.
So, you know, lay it out for me, you know, 10 years from now, what do you expect VFA to be, kind of a full-fledged, mature organization? What does VFA look like?
Well, it's funny, because 10 years from now is when our benchmark of 100,000 new U.S. jobs is set for. Our goal is to help create 100,000 new U.S. jobs by 2025. And for the discussion around job growth, we think it's really straightforward how you do it. First, you help early stage companies access the talent they need to expand and grow, to hire more people. And people always fixate on money when it comes to small companies. When if you go to any entrepreneur, you say, hey, what do you need? They'll always say, I need more talent. I need more human capital. I need more smart people to work with me. If you gave them the money, you know what they do? They turn around and try and hire a smart person. So you provide these companies with access to the talent that they need to grow. And then you ask your top prospects to become business builders and operators and job creators, as opposed to asking them to get their hand stamped and become, you know, a corporate service provider or, you know, like a deal person. And, you know, not that there's anything wrong with those things, but, you know, we probably have an overabundance of service providers at this point and not enough people building and operating. You know, there's a business school professor at Harvard who complained to me. He said, like, there's no one in my class that is an operator, like, because his class is just filled with people who are analysts and consultants. So we ask our young people to become the kind of operators that can give rise to job-creating businesses. And if we do those two things at high enough levels, then we can help create 100,000 new U.S. jobs in the next 10 years.
Andrew, I want to give you the last word. You know, it's been a tremendous path, and there's, you know, presidents along the way, and a book that's been written, and an inspiration for this podcast here where we are today. I'll let you, if anything you feel like you want our listeners to hear, it's all yours.
You know, I've learned a lot over the last 4 years, that's for sure, and I'm sure I'll learn a lot more in the next four. But I think the single biggest thing I've learned is just how personal it gets in terms of the types of companies these young people start, and really like how they go about evolving into the kind of people that can do great things. If you believe in science, which I do, like our brains don't finish wiring until we're in our mid-20s, like 25, 26. So no one graduates from college a finished product, which it shouldn't be shocking, because I certainly was highly unfinished when I graduated from college. And so the question is, how does someone get completed as an individual? Like, what you do for those first, let's say, 4 years after school can become very, very formative in terms of the kind of person you are and the values that you have and you live. And so that's been the most profound thing about Venture for America, is seeing these young people mature into, in some cases, like the best possible versions of themselves. And it turns out if you have really, really strong people, then you end up with people that are more likely to start organizations that will have a positive impact in their community. And so, you know, if you want to create companies, you have to help create people that will create quality companies.
Andrew Yang, thanks so much for joining us for a podcast that you kind of had to come to, but was still a lot of fun. And I know you wanted to be here. Maybe I'm projecting.
No. It's great. This podcast is now my proudest accomplishment.
There we go. Yeah, he's an old friend of mine and a great interview. And thanks for being here.
Thanks, Jeremy.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.